We start this morning with a history-making deal in California. The Yurok tribe and state agencies in California have agreed on terms that will return more than 47,000 acres of the tribe's ancestral lands back to the Yurok. Joining the exchange to help us learn more are my two guests. Tiana Williams-Clausen is director of the Wildlife Department for the Yurok tribe. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Josh Kling is the conservation director at Western Rivers Conservancy. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Tiana, before we get into the deal, tell me about your work with the Yurok tribe.
Well, I am the director of the Yurok Tribe's Wildlife Department, as you mentioned, and we're part of a multivalent team within our Natural Resource Division that includes forestry, environmental, watershed, fisheries, our carbon offsets projects, and things like that. We got started with the goal of returning California condor to Yurok ancestral territory, a deeply culturally important bird that is actually very representative of our world renewal ethic. And then expanded to other threatened and endangered species and now moving into habitat restoration. And it's been a really great ride so far. I've been here for about 17 years now.
So where are you from?
Well, here, I mean, with the Yurok tribe as a government, I'm actually from Klamath, California. So one of the major hubs of the Yurok reservation and the Yurok government.
Okay. And are you an enrolled member?
I am. I'm a Yurok tribal member from the traditional village of West Quell, which is right near Klamath. So basically, I grew up in the same place my ancestors had for thousands of years. So pretty close ties.
Nice. Josh, tell me about your work at Western Rivers Conservancy.
Yeah, I'm the conservation director at Western Rivers Conservancy. And our mission here is to protect the most outstanding rivers in the West. And we do that solely through land acquisition and conveyances. And we always work with third-party stewards. And we're incredibly proud of the work that we've been able to achieve with the Yurok tribe on the Lower Klamath and Blue Creek.
So how long have you been there?
I have been at Western Rivers Conservancy for 26 years.
26 years. Where are you from?
I am from Rochester, New York, originally. And I've lived here in Portland, Oregon, where our headquarters is located, since 1989.
So help me understand the terms of the deal.
Well, quite simply, Western Rivers Conservancy worked with the previous landowner, Green Diamond Resources Company, which is a timber company, family-owned timber company that we have had a very long relationship with, even prior to our work on Blue Creek. And we purchased the land in phases from Green Diamond, and then as we were able to cobble together funding sources from a diverse number of sources, we were able to then convey the land to the Yurok tribe. And we're so excited that we had our last conveyance just recently.
So you're buying the land from a private owner in order to transfer the land over to the Yurok tribe.
That's exactly right.
So where does the state come involved?
Well, the state provided some grants to fund the conveyance. Again, there was multiple sources, one of which were state grants. And so they were both a granting agency, and they also have worked with the Yurok to develop management plans for the property.
Okay, so the state agencies are on both sides of this equation. On one side, they're putting up money to make sure that there's a purchase of the land. And on the other side, they're working with the Yurok to ensure management of the land. And apparently, the state's involved in that as well.
That's correct. And I would defer to Tiana to articulate more fully how that relationship is unfolding.
It's a good segue, Tiana.
That is a good segue. And I gotta say, the actual transfer itself is probably what I would say above my pay grade. It's a very complicated sort of thing. So further questions there are good for Josh. But definitely I would say that the Yurok tribe and the state's relationship has both been growing and grown exponentially through this process as the state really becomes aware of the good work that the Yurok tribe is striving to do within their ancestral territories. Our actual reservation is only about 10% of our ancestral territory. And that's a complication because that means that the majority of these lands are actually outside of our reservation boundary, where we have our fullest kind of jurisdictional and sovereign authority as granted by the federal government. But we never ceded our traditional role as caretakers to the rest of the lands. And so, as I said, our relationship with the state has really been growing through this process and through just growing an understanding of what it is we want to do here, which is a landscape level restoration. Fits very well into California goals right now with 30-30 and watershed-style restoration work and multi-stakeholder work, like, for example, you know, bringing down the Klamath Dams. You know, that's not just in any way for just the tribal peoples. It's for our recreational fishers. It's for our commercial fishers. It's for the whole biodiversity and ecosystem. Same sort of idea for this sort of land transfers. How do we improve the lands and bring it back into a healthy state for the benefit of all our community members, human and wildlife and fisheries together? So I think it's been a really, really great growing and learning opportunity.
So who will own the land?
The Yurok tribe at this point is the owner of the lands. And so those lands are a combination of reservation lands, but then also fee lands is what it's called outside of the reservation. And fee lands are basically lands that are purchased and owned as anybody can purchase and own them. And so that's kind of where that co-management comes in as we find our mutual goals, because on these lands, we're working both with the tribal initiatives and also in compliance with California goals as well on these lands that are technically within California's jurisdiction.
So is the Yurok tribe a sovereign tribe?
We are. We have always been, oh man, anybody who's not aware of tribal history, it can get pretty confusing. We've always been what's known as a federally recognized tribe. The federal government never told us, oh, you people don't exist, that never existed, which unfortunately has been something that did occur to many California tribes. But we became a self-governing tribe or a sovereign nation in the eyes of the federal government in 1993 when we were approved as such and formed the Yurok tribe's formal government. So we've been an active government managing our own lands and our own needs since about then, at least officially from the federal government side, though we'd say longer, of course.
So whose priorities for the land are paramount?
I think that the tribe and the state would both agree that the tribe's goals are going to need to be the highest priority, because we are the original people of the land. And I'm not speaking for California governance or anything like that, but just working with the people who actually, manage lands or help fund lands and things like that, they understand that we have a deep knowledge of this place that was grown over the course of millennia. And we know what this land needs to be brought back into balance and to be brought back into repair. And they know that when we do this, it's only going to be to the benefits of the things that they care about, what fish and wildlife, biodiversity, water quality issues, things like that. So as we move forward, at least from a goal-oriented standpoint, though, state and tribal politics and relationships are always going to be complicated. I think we're very much an alliance, and there's a lot of support for the Yurok tribe getting done what it needs to get done in this landscape.
My guests are Tiana Williams-Clausen, Director of Wildlife Department for the Yurok tribe, and Josh Kling, Conservation Director at Western Rivers Conservancy. So, Josh, who are all the players involved?
Well, the primary players were the sellers, of course, and Western Rivers Conservancy, and now the long-term stewards, the Yurok tribe.
Okay, so there are, as I understand, some state agencies that are going to be involved in the management, co-management of the land as well. What are those agencies? Is that a Tiana question?
Yes.
I would say, I mean, for example, we'll put forward this prairie restoration project that we've got in Stevens Prairie, which actually ties to Blue Creek restoration project. And so Blue Creek is one of the land's kind of broken into two sets, and the Blue Creek Salmon Sanctuary is one that is largely focused almost exclusively on ecosystem restoration, Blue Creek being one of the most important salmon tributaries, both by providing cold water and actually being salmon habitat. There's a lot of work going down in that creek, and then Stevens Prairie is up above that creek. So Stevens Prairie is a traditional prairie that was homesteaded by one of our tribal families, the Stevens family, but was purchased by Green Diamond and became a forest managery unit, which was kind of actually beneficial in the sense that trees would grow there, but then they would cut them down. And so over time, it kind of maintained a prairie characteristic, leaving it one of the healthier prairies that we have in our landscape, which have otherwise been, you know, really brought down low. So we're going in and we are removing all of the remaining trees that have been either planted or encroached into the prairie. So the state is, there's rules that go along whenever you want to cut down trees, you know. So we're working with the state, for example, to figure out what is the most efficient and the most compliant way that we can comply with the California Forest Practice Rules. You know, so those are the sorts of things that we need to make sure that we're taking account of when we move forward on any sort of project. And again, a lot of these rules are very much in alliance with what the tribe would want to do anyway, because we're looking to be protective of these forests. But those are the sort of things that we have to go through still.
When you say you're working with the state, can you give me specifically what agencies?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, any agency that's going to exist, you're going to have to probably deal with at some point. But Cal Fire has been a big one. Mm-hmm. They've actually provided funding for some of the restoration work that we've wanted to do. Like I just mentioned, there's the California Water Board, if there's going to be any sort of creek restoration work. Same as anybody, if there is a state agency that has jurisdiction over state lands, at least for the moment, then we need to make sure we're doing things in compliance with them, which, you know, we're happy to do.
Gotcha.
Can
you describe the area of the land? You told me about Blue Creek and Stevens Prairie. I don't know any of that. I'm geographically ignorant of that region. So if you can give me a sense of how many square miles, where it's located geographically on the map.
Sure. So our reservation is primarily based along the Klamath River, which starts in northwestern California and then extends up into Oregon until it reaches Klamath Falls. Our actual reservation extends 44 river miles up that river, basically to the confluence with the Trinity River. Now, that said, these 47,000 acres plus that we have reacquired through this process are largely to kind of the north, northwest, north side of the Klamath River. It'll cut east and then kind of banks northeast from there. And so Blue Creek is pretty far down in the waterway. I think it's, oh, man, our crew will be mad at me when I misremember this, but I think it's 16 river miles up along the Klamath on the north side. And as I mentioned, it's one of the largest and cleanest tributaries that we have to the lower Klamath for fish habitat as well as others. Stevens Prairie is just along the northwest side of the Blue Creek area. But Blue Creek extends up into the mountains with several tributaries that flow into it.
So how much land did the Yurok originally inhabit and consider their home?
That's a good question. I think it was 100,000 plus acres, if I'm remembering correctly. I could be wrong on that. But so this is still only a component of it. There's other lands that Green Diamond Timber Company still has in their management, the Forest Service as well, Redwood National Park, as well as a whole host of other private land managers. That just kind of the history of the land has moved away from tribal management and moved to alternative management.
So originally the tribe had more than 100,000 acres, and now it's down to, including the 47,000 that's just been transferred into ownership, about how much?
We should get our GIS crew on here. I'm not entirely certain. I think it's something like 70,000 acres in lands that are actually owned. If I'm remembering correctly, I could be wrong there. And the funny thing about the reservation is we don't actually own all of it. It's more like a jurisdictional authority, like California is a jurisdictional authority, but California doesn't own all the lands in California. So there's a hodgepodge of ownership there as well. But we have been supplementing the Green the purchase from Green Diamond with other purchases from smaller landowners so that we can have continuity across the landscape.
Tiana, you were talking about the land, and I'd like to know, well, actually, I'll ask this from a listener who just wrote in. What does the land need, and what exactly will you all be doing in restoration? Planting, including certain animals or plants? What's the plan?
Sure. So we've got a long history of riparian restoration or creek restoration. That's only going to get bigger and better as time goes on. That was actually happening even before the transfer and has continued through the transfer. And major props to our fisheries team and watershed team and other people who have brought that into place. So, for example, a lot of the creeks have been left denuded of kind of the natural sort of architecture that a natural landscape would have had. But, you know, since the gold rush, basically, people were clearing those out and using the creeks as ways to haul timber and things like that. It caused the creek to not be complex, so it needs to have complexity added back into it so that it's can be good habitat for fish and salamanders and all that sort of stuff. The forest itself is much more overgrown than it used to be. It used to be historically we maintained just thousands of acres of prairie lands, actually. Prairie lands weren't considered to be as valuable. People came here and they saw our gorgeous big trees and they saw these lands as being valuable for tree harvest, basically. And so a lot of these prairies were either planted over for timber harvest or they were just allowed to be encroached on because nobody was managing them anymore. We'd been forced off the lands and we couldn't manage them traditionally through fire like we used to. And so our environmental department has actually determined that only about 1% of our traditional prairies are actually extant anymore because of these processes. But prairies are a huge hub of biodiversity, so they're going to be supporting our native ungulates like deer and elk, but also our insect populations, prairie specialist birds, our California condors, like big open prairies so they can do their foraging within them. But they're also really great in terms of just health of the landscape. So we all love trees. Trees have their place, absolutely. But when you get an overly dense forest, or you get a lot of these invasive plants too, they all basically act kind of like straws that are sucking up water out of the landscape at all this time. So we're going through and we want to clear out these prairies in order to kind of reduce that suction on the water. And we want to get the invasive plants out. So we've got invasive removal teams out there as well. Once these prairies are cleared, they're going to be reservoirs for water that will then let down into the creeks when they actually need it, like when it comes to the dry seasons of the year and things like that. They're also really great natural fuel breaks, so that if a wildfire should break out, they'll help slow it. And there's more and more evidence that they are going to be good tools for carbon sequestration, which is kind of more recent science, but something really interesting in this day and age.
So it sounds like...
As to the...
go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you. Go ahead.
As to the forests themselves... there's been introduction of more monocultures, so single species areas and things like that, because they were, you know, since basically, like I said, the gold rush, they were managed for profit necessarily more than environmental health. We're going to be going in there and doing a lot of what we call thinning from below, so selectively pulling out trees so that the trees that remain have the resources that they need and have the space that they need, so that they can grow larger and more quickly. And we're going to do it in patches, so that rather than having big swaths of like the same sort of tree in the same sort of area, we'll have patches of different sorts of trees to kind of mimic that natural biodiversity that would have grown up over time until such time as nature has the time to kind of recreate that biodiversity. So kind of accelerating our forest to a late seral stage through mechanical means and stuff until natural processes can take over.
Are all the lands contiguous, or are they all connected?
Largely. The portions that are more downriver, as we say, we tend to talk in terms of downriver and upriver, we've got a larger chunk there. Once you start passing upriver, there's some patchier ownership. That's where we're trying to fill in with some of these other purchases and the like. But we also have relationships with, continuing relationships with Green Diamond Timber Company for access, but then also doing some restoration work throughout their properties as well as we can, largely focusing on creeks. But we're managing this land in partnership with our neighbors regardless so that we can get do the best for it as we can.
And Josh, what's your role in making sure that the lands are continuous and continuing?
Well, we our primary objective was the conservation of the lands along Blue Creek and other associated tributaries along the Lower Klamath. And Blue Creek originates up in the Six Rivers National Forest on the Siskiyou Wilderness area. And it was just this lower portion of Blue Creek that about 15,000 acres out of the whole 47,000 that was in industrial forestry. And so we are thrilled that we have been able to complete conservation of the entire Blue Creek watershed, and that now the Yurok will be implementing all these terrific restoration projects that they, as they have been doing for years.
Okay. Are you brokering any other deals with the Blue Diamond Timber Company?
Not currently. It's a Green Diamond.
Green Diamond. Excuse me. My guests are Tiana Williams-Clausen, Director of the Wildlife Department for the Yurok Tribe, and Josh Kling, Conservation Director at Western Rivers Conservancy. So I want to visit something that you were saying, Tiana, about being forced off the land. I think one of you mentioned the gold rush and the destruction that that all caused. And then, of course, there's the timber industry and the impact. The conditions that led to this point were problematic, and we haven't actually touched on them. But I want to get your thoughts about this historical reminder from the ACLU of Northern California. It's a site called Gold Chains, and it connects Oregon and California in a historical timeline that many people don't know, and I'd like to get your response. And this is what they said. Peter Burnett was the first elected governor of California, 1849 to 1851, and one of the founders of Sacramento. He was a former slaveholder from Tennessee with a desire to create a whites-only American West. And in 1843, Burnett led a wagon train to Oregon, and he was elected to the state legislature here, where he took the lead in passing a law that excluded black people from the state, which, of course, led to Oregon entering the Union in 1859 with an exclusion law in its constitution. But in 1848, Burnett moved to California and helped create the city of Sacramento, and he was elected governor of California the following year. He again tried to pass laws banning people, black people, from California, just like he did in Oregon, but he was unsuccessful. But what he did do is he fueled the enslavement and genocide of Californians' indigenous peoples, and he signed a law that enabled white settlers in California to force native people from their lands into indentured servitude. And while he was governor, he brought in the U.S. cavalry and waged war on native tribes. And this is what he said publicly, quote, that a war of extermination will continue to be waged between the races until the Indian race becomes extinct must be expected. The inevitable destiny of the race is beyond the power or wisdom of man to avert, end quote. And then Governor Burnett later became a California Supreme Court justice. So those were the original conditions that led to where we are today. What are your thoughts?
It was pretty awful. And a lot of it is not well known, even by, I would say, our surrounding community members, not for any deliberate ignorance or anything, but like I remember myself, a Native student, going through school here in Del Norte County and learning about the missions and how great they were and how there was farms and the Native peoples helped out and all that sort of stuff, and this very clean, pristine version of what it was to be a California Native back in the day, and no mention really of our own struggles that we had up here. But it's true. There was definitely this idea that was supported by this first governor that the Native peoples were a disease or something to be eradicated, something marring what California could be. There was, your reference, but I can never remember what the full name is, what it's called, but it's basically this law that allowed for the indentured servitude. And I've seen some lists from Humboldt County, which is the county, we're in Dungarton, Humboldt County, basically. There's some lists from Humboldt County where there's kids who are listed as 2 years of age who are being indentured to white families until they're like 75 because of quote unquote debts that their family had acquired, which were entirely fabricated or were not communicated to their families. There was land that was quote unquote given to tribal members through the Dawes Act. But then, I mean, any Native peoples will consider that to be one of the greatest swindles in time, because then the federal and state governments figured out all these ways to get it back from them. For example, if the parents died, the parents of a family died in ownership of one of these allotments, the children were often not allowed to inherit. And then they absorbed any of sort of the debt that the parents may have accrued on it through not paying taxes or being told that they weren't paying taxes. And so they became indentured servants, which was basically slaves. So that was one thing. There was the cavalries, like you mentioned. Actually, some of the biggest massacres that happened in what's now the contiguous United States happened in our region. A lot of people down here are familiar with the Wiat Massacre that happened in the mid-1800s. There's also Talua Massacre up here in Crescent City. The Wiat one wasn't even the cavalry. What it was people hearing that people were being paid to slaughter natives. And so they just went out there and said, hey, if we do this, they'll give us money. So they did it on their own, just like this local militia, and right in the middle of one of their world renewal ceremonies. We all kind of share that world renewal ethic here. And so they ended up killing. The men had all been off as part of the ceremony, and they ended up killing a lot of their elders and their children, so their future and their culture holders. It was a bad time.
So does the passing of time magically erase all of that? I mean, why is it necessary for the Yurok tribe to purchase what is theirs? Josh, who sets the price for these purchases?
The conveyances were based on appraised fair market value of the property.
I don't understand that. Who? Give me a name or an agency. Who sets that price?
Oh, so when you are conducting transactions that involve public funding, then there are very specific appraisal practices that have to be followed. They're the federal standards, and they're informally known as a yellow book standard, and that's because the cover of the manual is yellow. And so the all the conveyances were based on reviewed and approved fair market value appraisals.
And who does that approval?
Through the state agencies.
Okay, and so the state agency sets the price, and the money exchanges hands and goes to Green Diamond Timber. Is that correct?
Well, so the state agency doesn't set the price. The appraiser appraises the property and arrives at a conclusion of fair market value, and then the state agency reviews that report to confirm that they got it right. And so, yes, that's how the appraisal process works. And then we would acquire the property and convey it in phases to the tribe utilizing various funding sources, whether it's from the California Wildlife Conservation Board, or through New Market Tax Credits, or the EPA Clean Water Act Revolving Loan Fund, and including carbon sequestration projects.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave that where it is. I'm not sure what's being done to educate Californians and the nation about this deal and the historical timeline of the events that involve the state and these indigenous tribes, but hopefully we can revisit this issue. Thank you both. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.